Red Film Radio.
Red Film Radio.
Interview.
Interview.
Please welcome Bradford's Science and Media Museum Associate Curator of Film, Tony Booth, and the museum's interpretation manager, Alice Parsons, with whom we will be talking about their exhibition on the father of the British film industry, Robert Paul. Tony and Alice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi there.
Okay, so this is really exciting. We're going to be talking about an exhibition on the father of the British film industry, Robert Paul. But before we do, I believe this is the first time that Fred Film Radio has actually interviewed a representative from the museum, the Science and Media Museum. But so I was wondering whether you could tell us a little bit about the museum itself, and maybe its sort of mission statement, if you will.
Yes, so we are part of the Science Museum Group. So there's a group of museums here in the UK that deal with kind of all things stemming from science. Obviously, our particular remit at the museum is with media, and we deal with kind of light and sound technologies, sound and vision technologies. And we started life really as a photography museum, then moved into kind of cinema is a huge part of our collection, and now also sound. And we do broadcast technologies too. So we have changed a lot over our history, but film and cinema has always been a kind of really core part of our collection. We look after about 3 million objects in our museum pertaining to all those different areas of the collection. And we do temporary exhibitions like this one, as well as having permanent galleries that explore things like TV, animation, gaming, the internet, all of those kinds of subject areas. And then our temporary shows like this one really delve deeper into specific either people or parts of history or themes. In this case, finally, a show about Robert Paul, whose collection we've had in the museum since our beginning. I think I'm correct in saying that, Tony. He donated all of his film equipment to us really early on, and it's a really important collection to us. So it's about time we got to do an exhibition on him.
Just a little bit about the history of the museum. When was the museum opened?
So our roots within the Science Museum, which has been around since the early 20th century, with its roots actually back to the Great Exhibition, which took place in the mid-19th century. But ourselves, we've been around since 1983, so we're relative newcomers, I suppose.
Yeah.
And started off as the National Museum of Photography, Film and Television. And our name has changed a couple of times, and now we're the National Science and Media Museum. So we're, less than 40 years old. But we're really fortunate in that because we're part of this bigger group, a lot of our collections, a lot of our objects have been collected for the past 150 plus years. So as Alice alluded to there, the material which came to us from directly didn't come to us, came to the Science Museum. He started loaning objects to the Science Museum in 1892 initially, and then subsequently changed a number of those into a donation, certainly the film objects, in 1913. So that's decades before we existed. But because we've got that shared history within the museum group, it means that our collecting has been going on for a lot longer than the museum exists, if that makes sense.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. And just to understand and maybe help us visualise it a little bit, in terms of the exhibition space, how many galleries are there and screening rooms?
So permanent galleries, we have, so the museum is set publicly over 7 floors. Yeah, because we have a basement gallery, and then, so we have 2 temporary exhibition spaces set over 2 different floors. And there was so this show, The Forgotten Showman, is based in one of those. And then we have permanent galleries for TV, a Wonderlab studio, animation, game, I'm counting on my hands as I'm saying this, Life Online, Kodak, have I forgotten any there? So that's 6, and the BFI Media Tech as well, which is kind of screening pods of the BFI archive that people can come and view in the museum. And then we also have 3 cinemas in the museum, a kind of larger cinema, the Pictureville Cinema. We have an IMAX screen, and then we have a smaller, more kind of intimate screen called Cubby Broccoli.
And in terms of film, you know, the museum is located in Bradford, and I understand that the city itself is the world's first UNESCO City of Film. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. It was given that that title 11 years ago now, and then, now there's a whole number of cities of UNESCO cities of film around the world, but Bradford was certainly the first. And I know the people that work there have been extremely collaborative and cooperative with these newer cities as well. So there's a real network of them that work together to promote film within their various areas.
Given Bradford's identity and also the fact that it's the world's first UNESCO City of Film, feel free to answer this question in any way you like, but what would you say about the current state of film culture there?
I think we tend to kind of look at it more broadly and always have. So we tend to kind of claim Yorkshire, if we get allowed to do that, particularly from a historical point of view. It's interesting because we have the work of Louis Leprance, if you go back to 1888, who shot what might be called the first moving pictures, open for debate, in Leeds back then. So that's kind of our starting point, and we try to kind of bring it forward from there, looking at the national context through a local lens, if I can put it that way. So in terms of what's going on within the district, there's still a lot of cinemas in our area which have been there since the 1910s and are still operating as cinemas. Obviously not at this exact moment in some instances, but there is that history there of people wanting to go to the cinema and continuing to do so. So some of these old cinemas are still in operation and are, you know, I don't want to say relics because that sounds like a negative connotation, but a real physical historical link to that film history. And then kind of bringing it forward, you have really vibrant programming going on in those venues, as well as more modern venues as well. And that's tied in with the film festivals as well, which happen. So we have a widescreen weekend at the museum. There's film festivals in Leeds, similar activities in towns like Hebden Bridge, as well as a small town which is really close to here. So if you kind of put these networks together, as well as the film education, which the UNESCO City of Film people are involved with, and other teaching facilities, again, in Leeds and Leeds Beckett universities, I think it's really quite vibrant, if not as visible to a lot of people who aren't involved in it. So I think it'd be great to make it more visible in the future.
Right. And we'll be talking about the new exhibition on Robert Paul in a moment, but I guess this is an unavoidable question right now, but how has the museum responded to the pandemic?
So obviously with everyone else, we closed just a little before lockdown happened here in the UK, and we just kind of, as soon as we could, tried to think about how we could continue our mission statement from home with people working or engaging with our content online, but also physically. We know not everyone kind of has, has access to the internet, computers, all that kind of thing. So as a museum, we also provided kind of physical content and learning packs and things like that. So we did some quick turnaround creative thinking, I guess, about how we could keep people excited about what we do as an institution that, you know, kind of exists beyond its building, and to kind of show that side of ourselves. And we did we've done online exhibitions for people. So things that were meant to happen, and obviously we weren't able to, you know, complete because of closing the building. We moved some of that online. We will be reopening next week, which is really exciting. And obviously we're doing all of the standard procedures of, you know, booking in advance and having less people in the building than we would usually have. But I think most of us are just really excited to get people back into the space, back into the exhibitions safely, and feeling confident with it. And it's been quite an interesting challenge, you know, working with our design colleagues and things about how to make the space feel, you know, refreshed and new for what we needed to do in these new guidelines of how we can, you know, operate in the world, but also still let people have that fun experience that they're used to having in our museum. With the Forgotten Showman, the show was meant to have finished we were planning on taking the show, deinstalling the show in March, which obviously didn't happen. So we've taken the opportunity to actually refresh it a little bit, which has been, you know, something we never have the chance to do, really. So it's actually been quite, we've tried to see a positive in that for this show in particular, getting some new graphics and some new objects in there and things like that.
Sure, I understand that. And also, I understand that there are some things about the physical experience that can't be replaced by the virtual world when it comes to exhibitions. But what are the current plans of reopening? Are there any plans in place?
Yeah. So we're reopening publicly next Wednesday. So Wednesday, the 19th of August. And people just need to book in advance online. It's still free to visit us, as it always is. But people just need to book that timed slot so that we know we can control how many people are in the space so that everyone can be safe and have enough room to enjoy their visit.
Now it's time to get into its current exhibition on Robert Paul, officially called Robert Paul, the Forgotten Showman. And just as a reminder, because you mentioned it earlier, but just in case I forget to ask again, what are the dates for this exhibition?
So the exhibition opened in November 2019, mm-hmm. And it was due to have ended already, but it will now be extended to February 2021.
And again, is this, has it been converted to a virtual exhibition, or is it still going to be a physical exhibition?
It's still going to be physical. Okay. The space is still there, and we've just done some refresh on it so people can still come in.
Oh, okay. Okay, so the first question, I guess, about the exhibition, very simply, who was Robert Paul?
Robert Paul is one of those figures that I suppose those of us who are interested in and work in film history think, why on earth don't people know who this man is? And that's probably one of the factors behind us doing the exhibition. So he was arguably the most important figure in the early days of the British film industry, comparable to the Lumières, comparable to Edison. He was an electrical engineer, had his own business in London in the 1890s, and was approached in 1894 by a couple of businessmen who wanted him to make replicas of Edison kinetoscopes being the first viewing apparatus where individuals could see moving pictures. Initially, Paul was a bit reluctant to do this because of copyright infringements, etc. But Edison hadn't actually patented kinetoscopes in the UK, and so Paul was free to make these replicas and did so. And this was his entrance into the moving picture business. He didn't set out to be a filmmaker, to be a film producer. It was kind of an opportunity which was presented to him. He had the engineering skills to carry it forward, and subsequently the business skills and the entertainment or showman skills to make a real success of it. So from those early beginnings, he subsequently started then to, he built his own camera in collaboration with Bert Akers, developed his own projector, because a kinetoscope is a single viewing experience. So he was one of the people that made the leap to projection. He subsequently built his own film studio, started producing his own films, and we think made around 800 films, something like that, throughout his career. And so really was a hugely influential figure, both in the art form, so the films themselves, but also within the industry and the technology which went into cinema. So he had so many spheres of influence in those early days.
And I'm curious, why is the exhibition titled The Forgotten Showman? I understand the forgotten part, I guess, because he's not talked about as much, and I do agree with that. But what about the showman part?
I think we're looking at that because of the way that he was one of the first people to take film and make it cinema, if I can put it that way. So in terms of getting together projection equipment, taking it to an audience, taking it to theatres, making an exciting evening of things. And if you look at his particular productions, he was clearly very aware of an audience and what an audience wanted, which I think is one of the key factors of a showman or a show person, that he was able to produce very quickly really interesting content, really relevant content. So the Derby horse race, for example, at that point was extremely popular. So he filmed this in 1896 and had a massive success with it. So he showed it the following day in theatres in London, and the audience were standing on the chairs and cheering. They demanded for it to be shown again immediately. And so I think it's that relationship. It's like presenting something spectacular in a spectacle, you know, spectacular fashion that the audience responds to, and then the filmmaker responds to that as well. There's this kind of back and forth relationship. And so I think that's why we consider him to be a showman, because he was presenting something that was a true spectacle to people, something they had not seen before.
And can you tell me a little more about the films that he was making?
Sure. To begin with, I suppose with many people in the very early days of cinema, they tend to be quite simple, single shots, static cameras, often actualities, or just filming people performing. So a lot of this comes from theatre. So a lot of the people that he was filming earlier on were performers in their own right. So the magician David Davant, for example, was filmed. But also he was looking for, at this point, kind of any subject at all. So he starts off like Rough Sea at Dover, which he shot with Burt Akers, was extremely successful, which is literally, as the title suggests, the waves coming and going at Dover on the coast of England, which I suppose if modern audiences look at this, they might think, really? Was this such a big hit? But the reality was it really was. And I think it's because of the motion, and that the whole point of film is that it moves. It's moving pictures. And if you've got something which has inherent motion in the image that you are showing, it's extremely effective. And also, I think from a technical point of view, if the piece of film is running a bit slow or a bit fast, then it doesn't really matter because waves move at a different motion. So there's actually, it's not off-putting either. Potentially can be quite hypnotic. So there are those kind of films, but then he quite quickly moved into fiction. I think he recognised that initially audiences were really captured just by seeing moving images, but then they wanted something else. It's the same today. You know, these are the kind of audience demands that tend to push the art and the technology forward. And so he started making fiction. One of the earliest ones, for example, is just a very simple scenario, often again, which came from theatre. People sitting, these two courting couples sitting on a bench and being interrupted by a woman coming in who wants to sit on the bench too. And then they subsequently tip her off the bench, and it's, you know, it's a big comedy performance. So it's a very simple narrative, but extremely effective. And then as he went through his career, these just became more and more elaborate. When he got his own studio, he was able to control the situation more. And he starts employing directors such as Walter Booth, who have a magic background. And so they are much more aware of this, of effects, of trick effects as well. So he starts making films which have dissolves in them, which have double exposures in them, these kind of effects which audiences hadn't seen before. So again, it adds to that showmanship and it adds to pushing the art form forward.
Right, yes. It sounds like it's a very varied filmography, and also pioneering some of the techniques that would be prominently used later. What's the exhibition structure, and what does it look like?
We kind of tried to tell the story. It's almost through chapters, because we worked with Professor Ian Christie, who is a real historian of Paul and recently published his book all about Robert Paul last year. And with Ian, we worked with a graphic novelist called Ilya, because he had produced this amazing piece of kind of like a graphic comic about Robert Paul called The Time Traveller. So, and we just loved these illustrations. So the space actually is populated with quite a graphic novel feel. And we tell the story of Paul from the description that Tony has laid out of him being, you know, commissioned to make these replica kinetoscopes, being an electrical engineer to start with, right through kind of patenting some new fit, his partnership with Burt Akers. But all the way through, we have these kind of characters with you as well. So you've got kind of life-size graphic novel style characters there. You've got the cells from graphic novels, quite large, to help communicate the story visually as well as in text. Obviously, we do go through it in text as well. And then because we have the Robert Paul collection. We have a lot of the original objects kind of along the way telling you that story as well. So the visitor can really see what it is we're talking about and how his designs and his patterns were getting more sophisticated as time went on and the way he was responding, as Tony said, to what the public wanted. We also have in there a couple of kind of immersive experiences. So on the theme of the showmanship, Paul formed a friendship with H.G. Wells, and they imagined basically, I think the closest thing we could compare it to now is kind of the 3D cinema, the kind of cinema experience beyond sight and sound. So he imagined, you know, somewhere where the seats might move, or, you know, you'd have other senses would be activated other than just watching and listening to something. So we have a kind of time, we have this section called the time machine where people can sit and watch a film with kind of movement in their seats and kind of air blowing at them. So it feels like they're moving around, which we kind of tried to say, you know, is this what he had in mind? Because obviously he didn't actually get to make it. And then we also have built a small cinema space in there to show a kind of reel of his, I wouldn't say best bits because we didn't get everything in there, but a real highlights list, I guess, to try and demonstrate as many of his films as we could. And then we go through, we also talk about, which we haven't touched on yet, the exhibition kind of ends with Paul leaving the cinema industry. And we talk about what he did after that, because he actually quit the industry after he kind of had a studio and was at the height of his success. And then the industry was changing and he left and went back to his electrical engineering business, really. And we talk a bit about, which you referenced earlier, Bradford City of Film as well, and what having that collection in Bradford means and what it means to be a city of film.
It sounds fascinating. Absolutely fascinating, really. You know, I wish I could visit it, and hopefully this exhibition will contribute to sort of a resurgence in the interest of Robert Paul, fascinating figure and the father of the British film industry. Well, we've gone over the time a little bit already, but it was absolutely fascinating for me to talk about this exhibition and the museum. So I thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
Thank you.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.